Welcome to Nerds Podcast number 419.
419? Got an episode?
What?
That's a take on an old classic wee joke, Chris. 419, got a minute?
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about your crazy drug subculture.
Me and my, it's like, you know, I used to do this, I wanted to make a bumper sticker that said, hey, it's 421, got a time machine?
Oh, it's good that you didn't do that.
Yeah, for us, but for those idiot stoners.
Wait, what? Why you gotta shit on the stoners?
The boozers and the stoners do not get along, Chris.
They don't?
No!
You're mad at the stoners?
No. Centuries passed. There was a time when they all lived happily. But until one guy got way too mellow and the other too aggressive and condescending, and then they never spoke again.
Hey guys, why can't we all just hang out? Oh yeah, right. You would fucking just love to do that, wouldn't you?
And ever since then, time has stopped.
Ching, 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 ching. Why am I doing these sound effects then?
This is a montage where you just see all the battles that were happening, like in the beginning of Nightwatch or whatever.
Okay. Oh.
Yeah.
That is so specific, and I know exactly what you're talking about. I know exactly.
Like, I'm sure there's other movies.
At one point, there was a divide.
Yeah. Exactly.
Or like Underworld, like the Lycans and the vampires.
The Lycans and the Draculas.
And the Draculas.
Yeah.
The Lycans and the Draculas.
Hey, can you find it weird?
Could you come on those Draculas?
Can you come on those Draculas?
All right. Wait, this is just the intro. Shut up.
Dog guitar. Hey. Pulling out all the hits.
In quotation marks.
Is that a wee joke?
No. Talking Dead and Walking Dead are back. I should have said the other one first. Walking Dead and Talking Dead are back.
Narcissism.
October 13th. Well, you're only saying that because you're a part of my reality that I observe. You're not actually a real person.
But hey, baby. It's your world. I'm just living in a baby.
October 21st, 2 on Comedy Central, At Midnight Starts, which is essentially a sort of like, it's a sort of game show with comedians. We're sort of going through and making fun of shit that we find on social media.
It's very funny.
It's really fun.
I was part of a
You've
couple of
it.
Test shows, and it's a blast.
It sort of feels like a British panel show in a weird sort of way.
Definitely.
Disguised as a game show. So that'll be on Monday through Thursdays after Colbert at midnight, and it's called At Midnight, and Twitter handle's At Midnight, starting October 21st. So that's that. I would like to thank Stamps.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Jonah, you like to mail things.
All the time, Chris. A lot of people, you know, for Jonah Radio, my other music podcast,
uh-huh.
A lot of people need to send me stuff through the mail.
So people are sending you stuff, but it's weird. I don't know how much a CD weighs or costs. It's going to be in a weird package, or I'm just going to send you a flash drive or maybe a record album.
Yeah, you got to put a Don't Bend thing on there yourself. Like, I mean, you got to go and do it. They have to do it for you. That's not fun.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, waiting in all those long lines.
Stamps.com, you could just do it right in your own home. You could send that right off to Jonah Radio. You could print out the exact postage you need. They're going to send you a digital scale. Your mail carrier will come pick it up and then deliver it right to Jonah Radio himself.
Yeah.
Your actual name is Jonah Radio, right?
I'm changing it. Yeah.
You should.
Jonah Radio Donovan.
Right now, there's a no-risk trial. Use the promo code NERDIST. When you go to Stamps.com, there's a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in NERDIST. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code NERDIST. Jonah Ray, this is the Slash episode, which was so fun. And Matt Myra was heartbroken that he wasn't there.
Yeah, could have talked guitars.
We didn't talk guitars at all.
Could have talked dog guitars.
We could have talked dog guitars.
Yeah, but it was a lot of fun. I was out of my element for the first 20 minutes, as you guys.
This is one of my favorite things about having about being surprised by like where the conversation goes is that I had heard that Slash was a dinosaur fanatic,
yeah.
And so we started talking about dinosaurs, and he is legitimately. Like, he legitimately knows dinosaurs. And so it was fun to kind of go down that path with him and see a side of him that I never knew about before.
I was out of my element. I know Tyrannosaurus Rex and Denver, the last dinosaur. That's as far as my dinosaur knowledge goes.
those two.
Yeah. Dino. I know a little about Dino.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but then beyond that, so
beyond
that's like,
that,
it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
three dinosaurs.
Yeah.
But Slash has a movie right now that he's produced. It's a horror movie called Nothing Left to Fear. It's in theaters October 4th and on demand October 8th. And you know who's in? I mean, there's a lot of people in Nothing to Fear. Anne Heche is in it, and James Tupper. But Clancy Brown. Love Clancy Brown. Slash produced the movie because he's a horror fanatic, and so we talked to him a little about that too. But really fun episode. The Nerdist Podcast number 419 with Slash.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hey cup. This is rad.
It's our clubhouse.
This is awesome.
We do our live shows downstairs, and we do a little recording. So if you want them, you don't have to have them if you don't like them.
Okay. Slash. So what are we talking about?
I don't know. We're just going to shoot the shit for a while, and then we'll release you back into the world.
Okay. Do you know a guy named Bob Morales?
I know the name. Sculptor guy?
Yeah. He's amazing. I've been trying to get in touch with him. He made a lot of my shit back in the day,
oh,
like in
really?
The 90s.
Do you work for Boeing at one point? The Bowen, the sculpture people?
Maybe.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Anyway, okay.
Rapping with Kyle.
Deep nerd vein real fast.
Yeah, did you guys get into a deep sculpture vein?
We just got into a reminiscing nerdy thing.
What was it? What were you guys talking about?
There's a guy that I used to I used to buy all these dinosaur sculptures. Oh, one of these guys who's very anatomically correct and has a great imagination for doing these dinosaur panoramas, you know, like sometimes really big ones. And I'd commissioned him a couple times to make stuff for me. So I had tons of his stuff up until, like we were just talking, until I put everything in storage and then eventually sold it all or gave it all to charity.
Oh, that's cool.
So now I have to start over. But I was just thinking, you know, I'm sure he saw where a bunch of his stuff was at the auction house.
Oh, and must have been like, what happened? What did I do, Slash? What did
you
I
know,
do?
Like, is nothing sacred?
I could put feathers on him. Do you want me to put feathers on him?
You know,
he was actually way ahead of his time as far as all that goes. Like, he had already gotten into this. Is like 94, 95, 96 through the end of the 90s. Anyway,
where do you fall in the Archaeopteryx debate?
Well, I mean, there was an Archaeopteryx.
Yes, but just in terms of like, it being like the first, like the winged dinosaur,
I'm a great believer in the whole avian thing.
Yes,
yeah, definitely. I mean, it's it all points to it, and it's so obvious when you look at the, you know, the skeletons and the similarities and the hip bones and all that. That stuff is very. You look at T-Rexes or any of the theropods' feet, and it's pretty telling.
That they look. I mean, you just look at a fucking ostrich and be like,
"Oh no, or an emu or a cassowary or any of those big flightless birds," and you see a dinosaur.
Where do the pterosaurs come in?
They're reptiles.
They're just reptiles with the. They just have the webbing that they can.
Yeah,
float.
Exactly. Yeah. They think that they had fur on them.
Oh wow!
Some of them had fur on them, more akin to bats.
Yeah.
The idea of rethinking. Dinosaurs as having fur or feathers instead of just
warm,
the way that
warm cuddly mammals.
Yeah,
no,
just warm.
I don't see it like that.
Giant cuddly, adorably huge.
That's why so many people got eaten. They just wanted to hug them.
They just wanted to hug dinosaurs. Oh, so many people got eaten. What are you talking about?
No, I'm sorry. That was
you're right. You're thinking Flintstones.
Yeah,
because that's what happened.
What
ultimately.
Documentaries did you guys watch?
No. The dinosaurs definitely revolted in the Flintstones.
Yeah. You know what the big thing that's going on right now is all these evangelical.
Oh, that all the dinosaur bones were buried all over the place?
No, no. Well, that the dinosaurs lived alongside humans, and they were actually on the ark, but they were just babies.
Uh-huh.
And I see them talking to groups of 500 to 1,000 people about this.
Well, you know the dinosaurs in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, the one near Palm Springs? Or
that got bought by the...
The Brontosaurus, which used to just be the gift shop, is now like it's a creationism museum.
Really?
So you can get coloring books with Jesus riding a brontosaurus.
Oh, but that's the home of Do You Have Any Dreams? Yes, I'm all alone, I'm rolling a big donut and a snake wearing a vest. Like, that's the fucking key, the key line from that movie.
Right before he heads for the Alamo.
God damn it. Well, I guess the Creation Museum in Kentucky, is that where it is? Does it have? There is a Creation Museum somewhere, and I think there are, like... kids with dinosaurs.
I think God's Green Earth is a creation.
I haven't been following
museum.
It that closely. I just happened to be channel surfing and watched this guy. This was a couple of years ago, and saw this guy talking about dinosaurs living alongside people and how it was fact and blah blah blah. And then I've seen it a lot since then. But I remember just being stunned. Like, you know, you're channel surfing. You usually hop right by that guy.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden, for some reason, something about dinosaur, and I stopped and I listened to this whole sermon about the reality of dinosaurs and people living together.
Did he have any science behind it, or did you just say it's fact?
Well, no, I mean, the whole thing is that the world has only been here for a certain amount of time.
Right.
And people have always populated it. They refuse to believe in anything prior to that.
And what is
and
it? So dinosaurs have to fall into
they have to.
And now since because before they discounted dinosaurs existing at all.
Yeah.
But now that they've had to accept that dinosaurs existed, they said, "Oh well, yeah, but those lived with people."
Yeah.
Damn it! How do we get around?
I had a bit that I was trying to make work for my comedy special last year, and I thought it was such a great concept, but the audience. Reminded me that they did not agree. But the idea was that when you look at the history of religion and science, that religion has constantly had to ebb its definitions to accommodate for science, but you've never seen the reverse happen.
Oh, that's funny.
Like, you would never turn on the Discovery Channel.
This was a great case
and
of that.
And that was exactly that. Yeah. Like, you wouldn't turn on the Discovery Channel and go, well, we used to think that the sun was this large plasma ball at the middle of our solar system. Now we know it's just an angry chariot of fire horses. You know, like, they never ebb the other way. Like, right, science has never been like, oh, you're right. Oh, sorry, you guys. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, you know, science is a very, you know, black and white science. Is, you know, everything has to be proven. They don't believe in anything, obviously, if it's not proven.
Sure.
And so, you know, they have to do all their homework and. They're very, very serious about what they do and making sure that anything that they discover has to be proven, you know, and has to be recorded and has to be named and all that kind of stuff. That goes along with everything, that, you know, that's scientific fact.
Right. Yeah.
So it's really hard to for them to miss anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I remember
we had
80 different scientists on the same subject or 800 of them waiting for the guy to fall off his pedestal, you know. Yeah. So.
But that's it. It's that constant search for a new truth. As opposed to the constant retaining of an old
the protection.
Truth. The protection of an old truth, yeah. We had Chris Jericho on the podcast a while back.
Chris, and he's a big dinosaur buff, too.
He is a dinosaur buff.
We text about it all the time.
Yes! Well, he texted you from our podcast asking you a dinosaur question. Because he was like, Slash is a huge dinosaur guy. And I'm like, what?
Well, there's only in my profession, I only have he's pretty much, I think, the only real serious dino geek out there that I know of, you know. So yeah, we text him. Yeah. I send him photos. Well, nobody else appreciates my dino stuff, so
I'm always,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, like,
who
exactly.
else do I talk to
when you find your friend?
I try to bring my kids into it, and they're like, you know, the Lakers are playing.
Are they playing with dinosaurs? Wouldn't it be greater if it was a team of velociraptors throwing a ball around? But I always I am fascinated by dino science from the standpoint of that they can find like a chip of a femur and they go, well,
they can identify it.
And they can completely identify it.
Yeah.
They can absolutely identify it.
I have a friend who is a professor in Canada, and she, I'm trying to remember the Tyrell Museum, as I met her there. And she and I text a lot because she's one of those people that can look at a piece of a femur and go, this is this dinosaur.
Wow.
And it's really amazing because, you know, it's very easy to go, what the hell are you talking about? How can you identify an entire animal, or, you know, with this one piece of bone? But they're so obsessed, you know. They have in the Tyrell Museum, which is in it's outside of Toronto, anyway, drawing a blank. So they have drawers and drawers and drawers and drawers of bones that have been discovered over, you know, the last almost not 100 years, but like 80 years or something like that. And some of it is, most of it's identified. The stuff that isn't are just these little pieces that haven't really gotten a name yet. But I mean, they have to memorize and know these pieces of bone inside and out. And a lot of recent discoveries are bones that have been laying around for years and years.
That were miscategorized? Or
weren't categorized yet at all. And then they find a skeleton that's missing a piece, and somebody goes, hey, remember that piece?
Oh, shit.
100 years ago? And next thing you know, they've all of a sudden identified a new species.
So it's a puzzle, basically. They're just solving giant animal puzzles.
Really wacky puzzle.
What is your favorite dinosaur? Do you have can you pick a favorite dinosaur?
I can't really. I mean, I love a lot of the small raptor dinosaurs. Before most of us knew what a velociraptor was, there was a Deinonychus, and I always liked that one, which is just a bigger raptor.
Right.
But most of the theropod dinosaurs, I think and I also like predatory birds as well. So,
right.
You know, they sort of, and I like the ceratopsians, and I like some of the pre-dinosaurs, like Dimetrodon and stuff.
Those kind of like lizardy, like those giant kind of blobby, where they're like,
well, they're not blobby.
Well, blobby in the
don't
sense.
Don't go there.
Okay, I'm sorry. But But when you look at like some of like the proto dinosaurs, they just don't look as sculpted yet, at least the way that they're depicted.
Well, they have the splayed out arms.
Yeah, they have the splayed out arms.
More like lizards.
That's right. Yeah. I saw an interesting story that this guy has a theory, and I don't know if it's a widely accepted theory by now because I just stopped following it. But the one story I read was that this guy believed that Tyrannosaurus Rex was essentially just a scavenger and
Jack Horner.
But I guess it was Jack Horner.
Jack Horner's got a great, you know. He sees things his way, and he's very right. I mean, he's made a lot of great discoveries and had a lot of great theories. But he has this one about the T Rex being, hey, you know, just because he's big and got huge teeth and he's got these great legs, you know, he's just a scavenger, and it drives all the other, you know, paleontologists nuts, you know, because then they start fighting amongst themselves about how fast it could run. Well, what about those useless alarms?
And yeah.
Anyway, and I appreciate Jack Horner's whole, he's got a visual, he's got a way, you know, that he describes how the T-Rex probably looked, which is all bloody and stinky and like his face is orange because
right.
it's just constantly scavenging.
Oh,
and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel very much that the T-Rex was an opportunist myself, but I don't doubt that it could kill on its own.
Sure.
You know, I think it was just it went after everything. Probably tried not to work too hard, yeah. you know, but went after any kind of opportunity, you know, injured animals, you know, anything that just happened to be stupid enough to run directly in front of him.
Yeah. Well, because I think the other part of his theory might have been something along the lines of that that if it fell over, that it's kind of fucked at
yeah,
that point because
yeah.
then how does it, how
but
does
then
it get itself
almost
back up?
All the big dinosaurs are in that category, really, if you think about it.
No, I guess that's
any
true.
Of them fall over. If, you know, yeah. a Diplodocus falls over.
Yep.
I mean, what's the chances of getting a 100-foot-long dinosaur to right itself?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure a kangaroo.
There was
can
a
get
lot at stake to staying upright.
Yeah.
Well, I guess yeah. Well, the kangaroos lie on their sides.
Yeah, but I mean, they can put themselves down on their sides. You know,
right?
I'm sure a T-Rex could lay itself down as well, but if it fell forward.
I like the romantic idea of a dinosaur just laying itself down by a bonfire.
Hello there.
Nursing.
Scavenged all this wonderful brontosaurus meat. It must be interesting for you with people. I mean, because now with social media and the fact that you can talk and connect more directly to your fans, that I'm sure people are not surprised to find that you're a dinosaur fanatic. But I guess in the early days, when you first kind of became famous, if you started talking to a scientist about dinosaurs, are they like, what the fuck's happening right now? Like, did you freak people out?
I mean, like, you know, I go frequent the museums and stuff, and I always probably looked out of place walking around the Berlin Natural History Museum. But I would just do it. I'd go to every country. I'd go to the respective Natural History Museum. But I started seeking a lot of these guys out in the 90s, like Jack Horner and Jack Baker and the guy from Canada whose name Chris something or other that from Terrell Museum. And I would pop up. And they'd be like, what's this guy doing? And I would know what I was talking about, and we'd have these conversations. But at the same time, there was always that look in their eye like, you're just a fucked up rock star.
Yeah.
Why are you talking to me about this? Yeah.
Did you try, like, did you use, like, when you were touring around the world, did you, like relish for, like, an off day just to have time
that
to run to a...
That would be pretty much my only destination. You know, like, we travel all these different countries, and I'm not much of a tourist. And I'd just stay in the hotel bar. But if there was a museum, then I would get up and go.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I really love the Natural History Museum in London for the Darwin exhibit. Their exhibit is fucking stunning.
It's a great museum. One of the classics, one of the great museums. You just stand there and go, wow, because it's all so old.
Do you own any dinosaur bones?
Do you
own like a skeleton?
No, I don't own a skeleton or anything. I have some bits and pieces I've had over the years and stuff that people give me, but it's all small.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not the kind of collector that's gonna go drop a bunch of money on a you know, like I have nothing to prove. You know? there is something though that's about to be auctioned off, which it is a young T-Rex fighting Triceratops. and it's been unearthed and it's being auctioned, and it's like $9 million, and they're trying to figure out who's going to buy it, and hopefully a museum will buy it, but it's a lot of money. $9 million is a lot of money for a government-run, a government-owned institution to pay for. And so everybody's, you know, on pins and needles trying to figure out if it's some private collector that has absolutely, you know, some rich guy could buy it that has absolutely no real appreciation.
Really, what if like Justin Bieber bought it and started Instagramming pictures of him on the back?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Woo,
and,
Canada!
Yeah. And put like a t-shirt on it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And a baseball cap.
Yeah, a backwards baseball cap.
Saying that these dinosaurs would have been Bieber fans.
T-Rex taking a selfie.
It would have been Beliebers.
It would have been Beliebers. Just like Anne Frank.
He just writes Selena Forever on the ribs. Like, what is he doing? Why would you do that?
But like, the hopes is that maybe a private person would, like, with that amount of disposable money, would buy it and then
donate it.
Yeah, donate it to a.
Well, we'll see what happens. So there's a lot of people just sort of like holding their breath to see how that turns out.
But with dinosaurs, Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know the story about Sue, right? The
T-Rex.
That was found. That was discovered by a private paleontologist or an amateur, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
A girl and her team, and they unearthed the whole thing, and then the government came and took it.
Oh, shit.
Yoink.
Said, this belongs to, I don't know if it was Montana or Wyoming or wherever it was. And so they came, and there was a big fight over this thing. You're talking about one of the biggest T-Rexes ever found, if not the biggest, and the most complete skeleton. So it's in a lot of crates.
Yeah.
And then they put it in storage while they battled this thing out legally. And then finally it went up for auction and the New York Museum bought it. That's sort of the long and short of it.
Yeah, that's where the state comes into like, oh yeah, we left this here. Thanks for taking this out for us.
Appreciate
that. We were going to come back to get this, but it looks like you already got it out, so we'll just take it. Yeah. I was going to say that a lot of what people understood about dinosaurs came from advertising. That a friend, my best friend and I had written a song years ago called American Dinosaurs, and it was all about, like, you know, patriot. It was a fake jingoistic Toby Keith style song about, like, the dinosaurs died so we could have oil. Now, we knew that dinosaurs did not become oil, that was a myth that was propagated by the, I think, the Esso company, or like one of the oil companies.
Okay. I know the myth. I didn't know who.
It was some type of, it was a petroleum company that propagated the myth, and that, not that, you know, fossil fuels are things like, fermented and decomposed plant matter, but that dinosaurs just fucking, some people for decades just thought dinosaurs just like they just melt into
oil. Because they called it fossil fuel.
That's why. Oh, fossils, it must be oil. But fortunately now at least a lot of people understand that that's
Nanotyrannus is the
term.
That's the name of another species of T-Rex that is a smaller one that they're not sure if it's a baby T-Rex or if it's its own species. And that's what's fighting with the Triceratops. It's either, I just had to say that.
There has to be a museum somewhere that has a slash wing, and it's all
no.
God,
they don't like to see me running around there.
Why?
Just doesn't fit the model.
But that's exactly why. That's exactly why it works. I mean, like you could bring in a generation of young fans that wouldn't necessarily think they should go in a museum, and they go, well, Slash thinks that dinosaurs are cool, so it's okay to like dinosaurs.
I don't think dinosaurs need any help for me to get young fans.
Well, at least
but you look fancy enough to be in a museum. You wear a top hat most of the time. You know, that's a fancy man thing.
That's what millionaires do. They wear top hats. But I have, you know, for a long time when I'm on the road too, I did like going to museums until, but didn't you find like, with your schedule, you kind of the same as a comic schedule where you go, oh, well, I only have to really, you know, work at night, so my days will be open. But they're not because they're you have to do press or you have to get sleep.
Or you have a day off.
Yeah.
You have to have I can't be bothered trying to get up in the morning before all that other stuff starts just to sneak out to the museum real quick, have a gander, and then pop back in the hotel. No, it's
why were you late, Slash?
If there's a day off.
I was helping scientists sort out dinosaur bones. No, really. That was the reason.
Yeah, I'm proactive. But not that proud.
what is in your mind, if someone were going to go to the best dinosaur museum in the United States, where would that be?
The New York Museum, Chicago Field Museum are great. And with all fairness, the LA Museum, which used to be the worst prehistoric monument, you know, or not a prehistoric monument, but a display of anything, you know, dinosaur. They just did a whole remodeling thing and brought in all this new stuff, and it's amazing.
Oh, nice.
It's one of the coolest museums I've been to.
I do remember getting literature from the Natural History Museum about, like, we're, you know, we're building more, you know, we're putting together more dinosaurs, don't they? They had, like, a dino drive.
It's really gorgeous what they did, you know. I mean, because I hated that museum, and I live here, and I was, like, so disappointed that I couldn't just pop down the street and go visit a great museum in Los Angeles. So they did all that, and so it's great. But there's a lot. You know, New York is one of my favorites, and I said Chicago. Pittsburgh has a great museum. I know I'm leaving one of them out. But so far, my favorite natural history museum, you know, in the vicinity of the United States is that Tyrrell Museum in Canada. It's nothing but dinosaurs.
Is that your favorite one in the world?
I wouldn't say. It's very new. And yeah. I sort of like the old funkiness of some of the old European museums.
Yeah.
I mean, I was mentioning the Berlin Museum earlier, and it has a herd of iguanodons that the way that they saw them back then, which was standing on all on two legs, but I think it was where they're completely erect with their tails dragging of thing. So there's a whole herd of them all standing like that. It's a great statement to, you know, the early days, early discoveries. It's pretty cool looking.
So when you were, I didn't realize this about you, but you were British born.
Yeah.
So, but you didn't. You moved to the States when you were a kid.
Like, I was like six. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I remember, I used to go to Crystal Palace when I was a kid because as soon as I can remember, I was totally into dinosaurs, snakes, horror movies, all that stuff. Like as far back as I can remember, and my dad used to take me to Crystal Palace, which is where, in the Victorian era, when we very first discovered dinosaurs, started putting them together, and we thought they were all just big four-legged lizards. And they have actual full-scale models in this park with foliage and all kinds of stuff and water and things coming out of the water. And it's been standing there for the last, 100 years.
Wow.
Fuck.
Where are we with dinosaur colors? Do we know, or are they just assuming that they were?
They've been able to get pigment off of feathers, and it's a limited amount of pigment, but it's real. Huh. And that's a recent discovery. They've had a lot of, you know, skin and mummified dinosaurs, but they haven't been able to figure out any colors.
They just don't know yet. So for now, the default color is just greenish brown.
Well, I just think it's always relative to the environment that they were in. You know, because if you look at most animals, they sort of adapt to the environment they're in currently. So since they can always figure out, well, this one lived in this used to be a swamp and blah, 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 then if it was a water-based animal, then it might have been, you know, one of four or five different sort of variations of, you know what I mean?
Rad.
But it's really still just up to the imagination. I think that's part of the magic of the whole thing is not really knowing.
That is kind of, I mean, and because we take things for granted, because we take knowledge for granted now, mm-hmm. because, you know, well, the internet, and you kind of go, someone's got to know, right? The world? Yeah, someone.
If you look
nothing?
It up on Google, it pretty much says the same.
It says the exact same thing. But did you come to Los Angeles first when you and your family?
I lived in Laurel Canyon.
Oh, did you really?
Wow.
Yeah.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to a couple, a few different.
Okay.
I went to Hollywood, Fairfax, and Beverly Hills.
Oh, wow.
And then I left Beverly Hills High in 11th grade. By that time, I was in continuation, so I was really only in it to smoke cigarettes. I worked full time, only went to school like a couple hours a day. Well, you know, you work at your own pace.
Yeah.
And spent most of the time looking out the window smoking cigarettes at the kids in the real school. Anyway, but I went to a few different junior highs, but I was basically raised in the sort of Laurel Canyon and the Doheny and Sunset.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I've been here since 88, and it's just amazing to me to see.
Where are you from?
I was born in Kentucky and I grew up in Tennessee, but my family moved a lot. I've lived all over the country.
Did you go to the races?
In Kentucky?
Yeah, once.
Yeah, the Derby?
Yeah.
Of course.
What a scene.
Big deal there. Well, my two of my parents' best friends when we lived in Louisville were horse breeders.
Mm.
And so they had this horse farm and we'd go back and visit them. And for some reason at the time, I was like, it's so much fun to get up at 4 a.m. and shovel stables. Like, as a kid, I thought that was amazing.
Yeah.
But the smell of this sounds really weird, but the smell of manure is like oddly calming to me because yeah, no, as that's a small
farm
child.
People have that. Yeah. Yeah. I can say this though, in Kentucky, the after parties for those Kentucky Derbies, some of the best partying I've ever seen.
Really?
It starts early with the mint juleps.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it ends early with the moonshine.
I mean, there's parties all over town. You know,
it's also funny because a lot of the people are derby dressed. So it's like they have these sort of like coats and these dresses, but they're just fucking tanked.
Yeah, they're tanked, and the women. Yeah.
You can say it. Okay, very polite. That's very polite of you. So you grew up, but just even since I've been here in '88, just watching Los Angeles. I mean, so much of Greater Los Angeles is so inhabitable now, and I remember it like, oh yeah, you don't want to go this far east, or you don't want to go here, you don't want to go into Echo Park. Like, it's all, I don't know, Los Angeles has become really inhabitable, but even as large as it is, kind of like what you said, I feel like there was not a lot of cultural things here.
No, LA is more of in the now.
Yeah.
For the most part. It's got some backstory.
LA's like,
not much.
Do we need a museum? Is that going to get me famous? Okay, that's not going to get me famous.
To look at the history, I mean, it was a desert until like 1930.
Yeah, when they had to start making it farmable.
Did you?
So it doesn't have a lot of history.
Yeah. What's like, you know, Burbank, the guy who founded the town of Burbank, his name was Dave Burbank.
Yeah,
he's
just a guy.
It's
just
Tarzana was named after Tarzan.
It's just literally the most boring stories.
Did Johnny Weissmuller live there?
Well, I guess when they shot that I forgot which version of Tarzan it was, who the actor was. I know who it is, but I can't think of his name.
Johnny Weissmuller is the only one that I can remember the name of.
Well, no, there's another one. The famous, real famous actor.
Stan Tarzan? I don't know.
Anyway.
Can we get that on the...
But yeah, because I lived in Tarzana for a year.
Did you really?
And I found that out. That was a piece of
just one
trivia
day.
For me.
Why is this Tarzana?
But the thing about LA is that it's got a short history, but it's very, very colorful.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
I mean, can you imagine
Sunset Strip? There's that movie. I haven't seen it yet.
Mayor of Sunset Strip, or
no? This new one that's a documentary on the history of the Sunset Strip.
Oh shit!
But if you look in books, like when I was a kid, so many changes from when I first moved here up until till now. Like I have vivid memories of all these things that aren't there anymore. And prior to that, there's a whole history that's very sort of. Celebratory, I guess.
Yeah.
But you got to live the Sunset Strip mythos in the 80s.
I have to say that from when I first moved here, it was pretty much bigger than life. It was so vibrant. I mean, it's still cool now, but I mean, it was so creative and it was so explosive.
But it wasn't nice like it is now. Now it's boutique-y.
Well, it was still sort of nice.
Oh, it was?
I mean, it's not strip mall nice, but,
Which is like
it was very artsy.
Yeah, because, I mean, was it that? Because, like, I watched that, there was a documentary on David Geffen, and he talks about, like, starting the offices for his, his label, like,
my dad worked for David then.
Oh, really?
In the Geffen Roberts?
Yeah.
Your dad was a designer. Was your dad a designer?
Yeah, I started first working with David when he was doing album covers for, what was the label called?
It wasn't Chrysalis.
No. No, Geffen is, but before that, before he had I can't believe I'm forgetting the name of it. But like Joni Mitchell and Jackson Brown and all these different people were on
Crosby, Stills,
and
Nash.
And so my dad did those album covers. So I was raised into that scene.
Oh, fuck. Which was the spillover from like the Laurel Canyon kind of.
It is. They all live there.
Yeah.
David included. They all live there. So like we all lived in this community. And so it was very much like more than a scene. It was a very communal kind of thing. The whole sort of like from Santa Monica up to Mulholland.
Oh, yeah.
And from Doheny.
That's where the Zappas were up there too.
Yeah, like, they're still there.
They lived on the same street.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, it was.
The corner of Lookout and Wonderland.
Yeah,
yeah,
that was a really
or the no Laurel Canyon and Lookout. That's the corner.
Yeah,
well, all that construction's been going on for years and years and years. That was the original Zappa house.
Yeah, oh, wow.
We used to have swans. I used to be totally fascinated with that. So I'm a big animal freak, and they had these swans, which they don't have around. They have swans in lakes in England, but they don't have them here. And so I said, swans.
That's really funny you say that. The first time I've only been to the Playboy Mansion like twice, and then I was like, well, I don't need to come here ever again. But the first time I went.
Why is that?
I don't know. It just didn't feel it's definitely not my scene.
He's allergic to tits.
No time is never
the right time for the Playboy Mansion. I don't know what happens. They make my dick impenetrable. Come on, guys. What? You didn't hit it.
I did.
No, you missed it. That's better.
Right.
But I was so fascinated by his monkey cages because he had these little monkey cages there. And then you would hand them grapes, and this is these tiny little hominid hands would just tear, just peel the grapes open.
That was a turnoff for you?
Yeah, it was a huge turnoff.
You don't do well at the zoo, I'd
be like,
spit it out, Binky. Now put it back in.
Asylum Records.
That's right. Yeah.
Asylum Records.
No, it's important that we talk about your monkeys.
Okay, your tone would suggest it's not important that we talk about these amazing creatures.
Which is your next record, Monkey Issues.
How monkeys ruined my little monkeys ruined my sex life.
That's really funny. I like the turn. It was like, we'll talk about dinosaurs for 20 minutes. Fuck your monkeys. They're not fucking reptiles. No, monkey lizard, fine. But we're not talking about monkeys. But that whole period of and then just sort of what it became, did you see the commercialism happening, or was it the same? I mean, like, every generation goes through the same thing. Oh, something's indie and cool, and then all of a sudden it becomes very, very commercial.
Well, I think I recognize that's a good subject. Like, for me, it's funny. I think it's just the evolution of kids, because, you know, when you're born into an era, there's certain things about that era that you don't necessarily like, and there's no reason for that. There was no one explained it to me, or just something I innately felt. And for me, the commercialism of the ideal of the sex of the 60s was something that bothered me. It became very sort of like everybody's a hippie kind of thing, and too much peace and love and too many flowers and all that kind of stuff after a while just seemed like there's aspects of it that I loved, but then there was this sort of very commercial aspect of it that you sold that was like, okay, come off it, And then and then in the early 70s and all that kind of stuff, I mean, that's when the 60s, that's what the 70s was, is a commercial version of the 70s, and sort of like just taking advantage of everything and everybody getting, the whole free sex thing. You just became like, well, let's do it for money.
Right. Why are we doing this for free? We're bad business
people.
The free
concert turned into the big epic stadium or arena rock thing and so on and so forth. But I mean, the thing about that I love about all like the 60s, what I know of the 60s, I was only born in the 65. So I only really caught the tail end of it but the 60s and 70s and 80s, at least there was something happening.
Right.
At least around here, there was three different scenes going on during the 80s and the 70s. There was all different kinds of mishmash of musical and artistic stuff going on. So it was pretty exciting. There is no scene in LA right now.
Yeah,
there's non-existent.
Yeah, at least
from what I'm used to.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be the real small subset of scenes. There's always smell.
Like a group of people at a party.
Yeah.
Well, no, like, I mean, like a movement.
A gathering.
I want to be able to I remember when in the early 2000s in LA, where it's there was a bunch of kind of indie rock emo kids that just started making electronic music and fucking and doing cocaine, and that seemed like it was all of a sudden everybody was doing
that. Well, it's sort of like with the DJ scene now, but it's not a movement, it's just a fad.
It's very true. Yeah,
I mean, it's all relative. It's all influenced by something prior that and it sort of evolves, but it doesn't become like this big. The scene here in the 70s was definitely like earth moving.
Yeah. Well, do you think it's because everybody it wasn't as much of a
it's dissipated niche. In the late 80s.
It's niche. It's niche. It's the nicheifying of our culture, and that everyone can have their very, very, very specific needs met, and so there's not really a reason on a larger big
picture
scale.
We're all on laptops.
We all have our fucking faces in our phones. Yeah.
Wait till the virtual thing comes out. You're not going to see anybody.
No. not at all. It's like,
but
you're good.
I was thinking maybe it's because
virtual headgear.
Yeah, where back then there was only a couple radio stations listened to. So if a radio station in LA is playing the same bands over and over again, everybody in the city is going to be into that. Everyone's going to be influenced by the same stuff, as opposed to now where everyone just listens to what they want.
Well, that's the problem, is that LA is too big. It's so big that the lowest common denominator is not that. Like, I don't think of LA radio as, LA radio, that's where it's happening. I haven't really listened to radio.
There was a period there when that was actually the case.
when it was actually.
Yeah, when KLOS and early stages KLOS and KMET, and there was definitely sort of an LA radio thing, but it's all, you know, basically everything has sort of been bought up by the by the corporation.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, when you guys started, did you was it really just, well, I just want to play music and I don't give a shit, or did you have a plan? I mean, was there any sort of method to it? Or?
No, man. I was racing BMX and listening to a lot of music and obviously exposed to a lot of music through my parents and all that. But I just happened to pick up the guitar because my best friend had one and he knew how to bang on it. And I was like, oh, that's cool. You know, and I was always fascinated by like going to see Linda Ronstadt at the Troubadour and they're setting up the gear, you know, and like that used to just get my attention. And then obviously when they played or going to sessions and stuff like that. So I always had a thing for what musicians did, but I never aspired to actually be one. And when I was, I remember exactly, it was like I was just before my birthday when I was 14 in the summertime, and Steve Adler had this guitar and I was like, that's cool, I want to do that. It was totally innocent, wasn't influenced by raging Led Zeppelin parties or, you know, Keith Richards, or at that time it wasn't about all that. And so I picked it up and it just within a 24-hour period I went from being a bike semi-pro bike racer to totally amateur guitar player, and that's all I did. And,
wow!
And that was it.
And what year is this around?
That's like late 70s, right?
Well, let's see, 1980. I would have been 15, so 79.
Okay, wow.
And that's really interesting because
yeah, 79.
I remember that sort of early BMX movement where it got really, because I had
that was
had,
in the early stages, like second generation. It was after just Steve Thompson. And
yeah,
all
it was
guys.
Just sort of. It was just. I remember seeing like those, literally just like dirt. It was just dirt and these fucking kind of rugged bikes.
Right.
That kids.
Well, I mean, we. You know, I'd like to pride myself in the gang that I used to ride with, which were all Hellraisers. But we were into, you know, quality bikes. We just didn't have any money. So, and we only raced on the weekends. Some of us had jobs because, you know, we were ranged in age from like 17 down to, I was like the youngest one. So I was 14 or 17, 13, 14. And we spent the rest of the week literally terrorizing all of West Hollywood and down Fairfax.
It was like a bike gang.
Really bad, yeah. You know, and getting chased by the cops all the time and just bad news. Racing over Laurel Canyon during peak hour traffic.
Oh, Jesus.
20 of us, right? So we would pick up equipment here and there. <let's say. laughs> But then it's really, it just switched over to guitar, and that was completely immersed in guitar. And the only reason I used my bike at that time was to get from point A to point B. It was weird.
Well, so, I guess being a BMX guy and being a guitar player, it's like when you first said it, I thought you were doing both at the same time. No. Yeah, except that you can break your hands when you're riding BMX.
I know, but you don't think about that kind
I guess of you
stuff.
Don't think about
it. Only
that.
For on hell track.
Now, I still have bikes, and every time I get on one, you know, it's like, you know, I start jumping off of stuff, you know, and you're going to naturally, at some point, you're going to fall, right?
Yeah.
So you're sitting on the ground, you go to get back up, and you're like, God, I got a tour in 2 weeks. What happens if I break my wrist? That would be a painful phone call to make.
I broke my collarbone trying to bunny hop over one of those parking islands in a grocery store parking lot.
Yeah.
My back tire caught, bam, and I just fucking slid on my shoulder.
Yeah.
Not good times.
But I used to have a bike out on the road with guns back in the early days. I think we were opening, you know, like during the whole opening period, you know, like we're opening for the Cult and Alice Cooper and Motley Crue and all. I had a bike, right? And then we were opening for Aerosmith, and I used to take my bike and I would jump off the stage into the stands, you know, and all this crazy stuff, usually with a bottle of vodka or something in the other hand. And then one day I got up and I got to the venue and went to go get my bike, and it just wasn't there. And it just disappeared completely. Like, no one said anything about it. I you know, of course, I discovered later it was insurance kind of thing.
Yeah, the Aerosmith guys
were like, look at this guy. He's gonna bite it, and then he's going to cost us a lot of money. So they took it. Not Aerosmith themselves, but their tour manager. Tim Collins and said tour manager.
Steven Tyler is throwing your bike into a pit while singing Walk This Way. At the same time,
right.
Was that when you were first? Did you realize that the sound that you guys had, that you were creating this kind of new innovative thing, or was
influenced by BMX?
Yeah, all the early songs were about dirt bikes.
Right.
Did you have any concept of that at the time, or was it just like gig to gig? You're just trying to get through it.
I'm not sure exactly what you're saying. So was all those songs influenced by...
No, I'm saying like at the time when you're touring with Aerosmith and you're opening, are you thinking that there's this grander thing that's happening at that point? Or are you just no, we're just playing because it's fun?
I mean, well, you're aware that, you know, you're sort of, you're growing on that. You've gone from playing this size venue to this size venue, and you come on stage and people actually know who you are.
Yeah,
there's a point there where they didn't have any clue who you are and why are you taking up space, precious energy, wasting our time. And then eventually it starts to catch on, and it was at that during that Aerosmith run where it was really peaking, but way beyond what I was conscious of. You know, all I knew is we get out there and people actually knew what that song was or what this song was, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And then it turned into something else afterwards, but I didn't know it was going there at the time.
Were you touring a bunch before Appetite came out?
That record was out for a year and a half before anybody really paid any attention to it. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
What was it? What broke
it? Was
it?
A record. No.
A record?
No, what was record. It? What broke it? I mean...
It was like an MP3 file. But
no,
flat.
I think it had a cool... it had a cool sort of underground kind of buzz that was, you know, slowly growing over that year period. And I think, you know, as much as I hate to admit it, I think the thing that really broke it open... you know, like made it sort of crossover was the whole MTV Sweet Child of Mine thing.
Yeah. Oh,
wow. Which I didn't see coming, you know.
But I always want to find out from the idea that a guitar player has an identity and that there's a specific sound. I mean, I don't really understand everything about music, so I think, well, there's only a finite number of sounds that someone can have, but how do you find your identity in a sound and a style, and what is it that you think defines, like, oh, that's that guy, or that's that guy?
Well, like, you know, let's not talk about me, because I don't have any idea what goes on there. But when I was first picked up the guitar, you know, there was definitely, you know, before I even knew what different guitars sounded like, I identified sounds with the look of the guitar of the guy that was playing it.
Uh-huh.
Right, so you know, you had your guys like Eric Clapton who were very identifiable sonically, and Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, Keith Richards, Mick Taylor, Brian Jones. I could start doing Rick Nielsen, AC/DC. They all had a identifiable sound, and you would. I mean, that's really the thing most important. Aspect. It wasn't even technically how great they were. It's just that they moved you when they played and that you could recognize who they were just by listening to them. And then you sort of like, well, I want to be like that. And so you sort of see which one has a sound that you want to emulate and what kind of guitar do they use. Because technically you have no idea.
Right.
You know, Jimi Hendrix is one of those guys where, you know, there's a sound that you can hear a mile away.
Yeah.
And so I think I sort of identified. I mean, that's looking back. I don't think I was really conscious of how it all worked in my mind at the time. You know, I mean, but that was the process. This guy's cool. He's got a cool songs, cool solos, and this is the guitar that he uses. And that's somehow that must work.
You know? It's kind of fortunate that this scene sort of sprung up at the right time for you, because otherwise you could have just been a troubled kid. You know,
I mean, it wasn't the scene so much, but I think it was probably inevitable. Because of the amount of music background that I had, it was just waiting to get uncorked. I don't think I had I had any aspirations to. I mean, my main ambition, I think, was to become a motocross racer, mm-hmm. but I could never afford it.
Right.
Yeah. So you know, I didn't really have. Still to this day, I don't look much farther than next year. So I don't know what I'm doing.
But in that time, were you like going to see a lot of bands play? Like before you started the band, like what were those bands? Who were those bands?
I mean, well, when I started as a teenager going to my own rock concerts, you know, Void
as opposed to,
and stuff. It was like Aerosmith. I remember going to Van Halen, you know, the Cheap Trick, the Ted Nugent, those bands that were all happening at that time. And then there was a lot of what was going on in the club scene, which was a little bit different. You had, you know, Black Flag was playing, X was playing, Fear, which still is one of my favorite bands of all time.
You ever see that footage of them on SNL?
On SNL.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think so.
John Belushi became a huge fan. Yeah.
Maybe I have seen it.
Yeah. It's
I remember leaving being on
They it's not available. Like, it's really hard to find because they cut it out of any repeats. But John Belushi became a huge fan when he was living out here. He became a huge fan of Fear and became friends with Lee Ving, the singer. And he was going to come back to host SNL after he had left, and he convinced Lorne Michaels to have Fear play. And so the music bookers were like, well, we can't have
this.
It's like a really cool story. It's like we can't have New York hardcore kids and punks coming to see Fear at SNL
because it'll mess with the rest of the
it'll just be too crazy. And so they heard about the DC scene at the time, which was Minor Threat and Rise of Spring and all these bands that were straight. So they're like, let's get these sober kids to come up from DC and then they'll be the audience for the Fear show.
Well, they don't drink, so they're probably really calm.
That's the thing. It's they had no idea that they would be even more crazy. And then right when they start playing, it was a Halloween show. They pick up all the jack-o'-lanterns on stage and smash them, and it's just a chaos.
Well, the thing is they're all sober, so they're tireless.
Yeah, exactly.
They're like ever ready.
Alcohol is a depressant. It does take
you have that first half an hour of full on, and then you start to wind down.
Fear, and I guess the Germs was around that same
time. Yeah, the Germs. Yeah. So that was the sort of the club scene. And then as it got into, 79-80, then you had Nicky's old band London, which was pretty cool, and the sort of post Van Halen sort of glam scene that came along. So it was all pretty exciting.
What is the difference for you in the, because I also am very interested how a band stays together, because as comics you're just yourself and you go up and you don't rely on anyone, but when you want to just play
music, a DJ.
Yeah, like a DJ. Exactly, like a DJ.
It's a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
I started to realize that lately.
Especially when you didn't have to bring your own records. You can bring your laptop and your Serato.
You don't have to go to the Linda Ronstadt concert to see them put all the equipment on stage. There's just a guy. That's why I always wonder, why do people go to concerts just to see? I guess you just go to dance. You don't really go to just watch.
No,
impressive DJs.
I've been to a lot of these, and especially I went to Ultra Festival. I actually played there, and it was this is a massive, massive festival, like any of the biggest rock concerts you've ever been to, and I'm checking it out, and the people all pointed in that direction. It's not like here's a guy over here spinning some music, and there's this huge pit of people just dancing, not in any particular direction. They're all facing the DJ, and they build these very extravagant stage setups, but there's just the one guy who you can barely see. And he's just sort of standing and raises his arm every so often. And I'm seeing a lot of production people, roadies and whatnot that I know from my gigs. What are you doing here? And it's like, it's work, It's like there's no equivalent to this, except with the exception of a couple of big rock bands, Metallica or whatever, going on right now. So it's like, and it's also that's where all the kids went.
Yeah.
It's like the roadie used to bring on another guitar. He runs on with a flash drive.
Hands
to the guy.
He's got one in his back pocket.
In that Steve Coogan movie about Factory, the 24-hour party people. He has that. There was that part of the thing. He's like, and then I realized there was a bunch of people in the club. Everybody's dancing, but they're all looking at a DJ. And that's where the money was.
And it's weird. They're all sort of staring in that direction. And I see tour managers I worked with before and managers, all hanging around, mostly English dudes. And they're like, well, it's where the money's at.
Yeah.
And you're just sort of like, God, it's depressing. Yeah. And then I'm going to the different, this is Miami. So I'm going to the different hotels and these different parties and sort of just hanging out, and I got people walking up to me going, oh man, you're so from so and so, and he said, I was so into that, but then lately there hasn't been much to listen to, so I'm into this now, I'm like, wow.
Yeah, you can listen to both.
No, but that was when they were at this age.
Oh,
where
yeah,
they're
yeah.
at now, there's like there's nothing currently going on, so
yeah.
So the idea of keeping a when you just want to play, you just want to, we have a job, let's just go up, we want to play, we like to play music, but then other stuff gets in the way. How do you keep, how do you keep a band? What are the politics of a band? What are the politics of a successful band?
Oh, dude, I think it's different for every group, really. I mean, I think the universal thing is you all got to want to do it, it's a lot of work and it's a lot less glamorous than everybody, or at least what it looks like in magazines. and you got you all have to be you have that sort of common idea that you want to do this and love it, and then the rest of it's really personal. It's, you know, each band has their own internal dynamics and, you know, how they work together and all that kind of stuff. So I can't give you a quick overview of how it works.
Okay, well, how did it work for you?
Well, we split up.
I know you guys split up, but
up until then, it was exactly what I said. It was just the like-minded ambition to go out there and do our thing, and we were all basically on the same page.
Does fame and success kind of ruin people, or do you feel like they just come in with the issues they had?
No, I mean, in a lot of cases, fame and success bring people around you that help ruin you. You end up with a lot more people around you than you started with, and they have different agendas, I mean, than what you initially started out with. I don't think, I mean, at least for me personally, it was never about fame for fame's sake or money for money's sake or any of that stuff. It was really purely about music, still is. But then you get these people around you that have a completely different agenda. It's totally financial oriented, and you know, you have to be smart at a young age to be able to you have to be able to see where those people are coming from. You know, usually you can spot them, but it's the real insidious ones that just sort of yes you to death, and you think they're, you know, trustworthy, and, you know, in some ways they are, but in a lot of ways they're thinking for themselves.
Well, even at that time, because I think young artists now are probably much more.
They're very money oriented.
More like
it's a whole different industry
because now so many people have to, like, a lot of people have realized, like, oh, you kind of have to just take control of your own thing.
Yeah, but now it's like, well, what should I play so that we can become famous?
True. But don't you feel like it was like that back then too, like, especially with, you know, like, once, you know, when fucking hair metal was popular, I'm sure a lot of bands were like, oh, we need crazy hair.
I always hated that scene anyway.
Yeah, I'm sure.
We were like in the midst of that, we always hated it.
That's why I like, every time I see a guy that's really into Pantera, I like to show him early pictures of those guys when they were in a hair metal band.
When they were the glam thing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, let's be truthful. Every single band or artist at at their earliest stages were much like what was happening at the time. You look at the Beatles, and they always said that.
Yeah.
Look at the Stones; they look like the Beatles. They look like the Kings. And so it always happens. But then you sort of evolve your own style, and you become very much yourself. Mm-hmm. But with the whole hair scene. You know, from my vantage point, being in the midst of it, like, we were like the antithesis of all those bands, so we hated them. And, you know, most of them were in it for the booze and the chicks and whatever cash they could get. Mm-hmm. And some sort of notoriety. There wasn't a lot of substance musically in that scene. But then, of course, there was individual bands that were really cool here and there, you know. Yeah.
Do you think, like, going to see some of those shows of, like Black Flag and X and stuff like that, and then also having, like, a foot in the Sunset Strip scene, like, kind of gave you, like,
well,
kind
the Starwood was playing them both.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the Starwood and the Whiskey had, you know, you had like your Quiet Riot and your bands, like I was talking about, London and Exciter and a couple of those other bands. And then the next weekend you could have the Germs playing. So it was all sort of going on at the same time.
Hmm. Wow. When you sort of look back, how did you break up? How does a band break up? Is it done through lawyers? How do you break up? Is it lawyers?
You're going into no man's land.
Am I really?
I don't talk about this stuff. It's only because it's become
a bigger
subject than
it don't talk
always
about it
turns
then.
Out negative.
And I don't care. Don't talk about it then. That's totally fine. Talk about dinosaurs. Okay. But I. Yeah, I don't.
Obviously, much more fascinating.
Well, I mean, I don't mean to put you on the spot. I'm sure you've been through that a million times.
It comes up all the time.
Well, only,
but just from experience, I've just gotten to the point where, you know what?
It's not worth talking about.
Yeah, I mean,
my fascination of it is only from the performer side of, I really do think that a group dynamic, like, I look at the Rolling Stones, I'm like, how the fuck do they, like, how does a band like that stay together for that many decades and still have the same, how did they,
together on stage.
Unless you actually have, you know, because, I mean, what you see on the surface and what goes on internally are two different things. And so, like, I know a lot of guys in a lot of different bands, and I sort of know what goes on in each one of these different bands. It's all similar and it's all very different, but you can't verbally express any of it you know, from the outside.
Sure. Yeah.
Somebody from the inside has to say.
But don't you like when
what doesn't even cover, you're not going to get the whole picture.
Don't you ever feel like when you see someone's parents are still married, you're like, wow.
Well, yeah.
How did you do that?
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah.
You know, like when I was a kid, if someone's parents were divorced, it was like, they're divorced. Yeah. But now it's like, they're married? Like, it's still crazy to me. Yeah.
But I mean, it's a lot like a relationship. Like that, you know, imagine, I don't know if you don't look.
I have a girlfriend, but I'm
not. You have a girlfriend.
Yeah.
Imagine, you know, three additional ones. but with different personalities,
sure.
Obviously.
Big love. Just it's like big love.
Yeah, trying to all work it out together. But then add some coke and add some booze and add some wacky, idiosyncratic ideals about what life is supposed to be about and throw it all together and, you know, put it out there.
Yeah, put it on the bus for a long time.
It's a balancing act. You know, I think the only thing that you might have a good bond between a couple of the guys that really goes deep, maybe from childhood or something. And then the most universal thing that ties it all together is the actual passion for music. And you have that, hopefully, that chemistry where you musically are in touch with each other. And that's what really holds it together.
Go ahead.
Did you ever do that thing? Like when I was in bands, like it's like me and my bands like would always like fight and internally, and then like we'd be at a show and we see some other bands like just hanging out with each other, like, why do they get along so well? You talk to them, they're like, oh no, we're fucking fighting constantly.
Yeah, I mean, really, when it comes down to it, the grass is never greener.
Yeah. Exactly. They got it all figured out.
But maybe it's not supposed to last. Maybe that's what's supposed to, the soul of it is supposed to be like, you have a moment and then you enjoy that moment and then you move on and create something else.
Yeah, there's no sort of rule, you know? I mean, the Stones blow. I mean, well, the Who as well, you know, even though there's only a couple of them left.
Yeah.
But and Aerosmith is another great example. And those guys, you know, the Aerosmith guys I know really well, and they're awesome people, like each one of them. But they almost purposely fuck with each other.
Oh, really?
And then they get to the point of breaking up all the time. But somehow they manage to reel it back in just because they want to play, you know, and then they play great as a unit. It's something that none of them as individuals can find elsewhere. So it brings them back. So it's really always about the music.
Yeah, and they don't need to play to make money at this point, right? Like they're probably pretty.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, yeah. I don't ask those kind of.
Well,
questions.
No, I know, but like I'm assuming that like it's
they
like
just do it because they want to.
They can pretty much ride out the rest of it.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, they play for the love of it, and the Stones are having a great time being back together, even though it takes, you know. It takes a lot of business to be able to get them to go, okay, we need to get back together and deal with each other. But once they get up there, you know, the magic of actually producing music is what keeps it going.
Yeah.
It always comes back to that.
Yeah.
If you don't dig playing, if you don't dig playing and don't like music or just sick of the whole thing, it's really hard to come across as believable. You know?
Well, it's like when the Police played, you know, it was like they were getting... I don't remember how much money it was, but it was fucking ridiculous.
I saw them, not live, but I saw Sting a couple times, and he was just bitter. Yeah. Sure, when will this end?
Which is such a bummer, because you know, you think like, wow, it's so, the problems are so bad that they can't just say, guys, I know that normally we hate each other. People like our music. We're going to get paid a lot of money. Let's just fucking do this. Yeah. And let, like,
boy,
let's
I've
just...
heard that one.
I saw like pictures of when At The Drive-In got back together to play Coachella. Someone like put all these pictures on this one blog together of like them rolling their eyes at each other during the show.
Right.
It was like you could tell.
There's a great movie out called The History of the Eagles. Right, it was not a band that I used to pay a lot of attention to, but I was on the bus and this movie was playing, and it was really from the before the Eagles' inception back here in Laurel Canyon, and like when a couple of them were in the side band for Linda Ronstadt, right?
Oh, and always the tying it together,
and it just told the whole story of how it, you know, became the Eagles and who was in the band and how the dynamics worked then, who got kicked out, why they got kicked out, the next phase of it, blah, 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 all the way up until present day. It's a really fascinating, fascinating movie. And there's a lot of players in it that I know very well, you know, throughout the whole story. And you're just like, you know, it's really interesting because you don't know that much about what goes on you know, behind closed doors or what goes on behind the scenes with a group unless they come out and tell you.
Yeah.
And they usually don't want to talk about it. No. Like, I don't want to talk about it. Yeah. But, you know, when you put out a movie like this, you're just like, wow. You know, and it's great because you can relate to some of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Does it make you feel better in some instances? You're like, well, they were really fucked up.
Well, no. No, because it's painful to watch. It's fascinating, but it's painful. And you know, with those guys, I mean, they had a pretty rough and tumble period there. Yeah. And then they finally said, fuck it, and split up for, was like 10 years.
Until the hell freezes over to her. Well, then I guess it is really just like, I mean, you're right. It's like a relationship. And you see a couple, and you don't know what their personal dynamics are like when they're in their homes. And I imagine, you know, if a couple hates each other, if someone said, look, you guys could go live on top of one another in a bus for a couple of months, and then you'll get this money. They still, at a certain point, they'd be like, I fucking can't do this.
It's like being a junkie. You can't tell somebody how to fix it. You have to fix it yourself.
Right. Yeah. But then not only do you have to fix it yourself, but everyone's goals have to be aligned and everyone's personalities have to be complementary. And, you know, just like in a relationship, I imagine if, you know, the bad combination is if you have a bunch of neurotic people and this person's neuroses rubs against this person's neuroses and then this person, like, and then it just creates this sort of weird chain of, like, It's chemistry.
And you don't have, you know, the therapeutic reinforcement to learn how to deal with it. You know, I mean, that's the other thing.
Because like, someone took your bike.
Well, yeah, exactly, right? I mean, nobody knows exactly how they're supposed to handle the situation, but in the heat of the moment, you just deal.
Yeah.
You know, however your personality sees fit to deal with it.
You know? Well, how do you, I mean, you seem like a pretty well-adjusted guy, so how did you get to that point, or were you always pretty chill about stuff?
I've always been pretty laid back. Yeah, I'm not real confrontational, so I'm not the guy that picks fights. You know, at least in a band setting. But yeah, there is whatever that happens.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm too mellow.
No. Listen, there's no shortage of people willing to pick up the freak out baton if you don't want to have the freak outs.
Yeah, when I was a kid, you know, talking about all the sort of history living around the scene in LA, man, I saw all kinds of crazy people that, you know, with their artistic entitlement, you know. Yeah. And I think I pretty early on started, I don't want to be that guy. You know?
Yeah.
That definitely stuck with me. I saw some really great, very inspiring artistic, you know, either musicians or writers or whatever it was. But for every one of those, there was five really crazy out there, didn't make any sense, you know. And there is that sense of entitlement that says I can be like this because I'm an artist and all that kind of shit. And I was like, I don't want to be that guy.
Well, that's good. Well, and also, you know, like the people around, like you said, the people around don't do that any favors because they're like, oh, yeah, go ahead, freak out. Like people will...
Oh, the enablers.
Yeah, the enablers, yeah. I mean, it really is like... People
one
become,
hand on your shoulder and the other one in your back pocket.
Exactly. There is sort of like the same way that a, you know, like a goldfish will sort of grow to the size of the bowl that it's in.
Mm-hmm.
That it's there is sort of a monster thing in people that they will. So a lot of them will monster out to the size that they are allowed to.
Give them an inch.
Yeah. Because you're constantly like testing boundaries. Oh, that's okay. Oh, I guess I can do this. I guess I can do this. And you really do. You either need to be well adjusted or you need to have someone say like, you're kind of being a dickhead right now. Can you please stop being a dickhead?
Yeah, I think that's the main thing that probably that needs to happen is where you can be straight, flat out honest with each other from the get-go.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's important.
Without having to bring in a therapist like Metallica did.
Well, back in the day, they didn't have therapists, but then, Metallica brought that on. I never saw that.
Oh, you have to see it just for the one moment.
I didn't want to see it.
There's one moment though, and it's like you know, the therapist like is just telling him like it's like, you know, you guys are going on the road soon, I'm gonna have to come along.
Oh,
and
yeah,
like,
I heard
well,
about
that was
it.
Really part of the deal. And then like it's what you need to do, believe me.
Right.
And then they're listening, they do a thing where they put down a bunch of music and then they all, you know, listen back to it and write down ideas for lyrics for James. And then like there's so like, you know, Kirk is handing James a little piece of paper, Lars hands him, and then like the guy like like reaches a bit too. It's like it's almost. It couldn't have been said it better in a movie. Like he's kind of on the edge of his seat, handing James a piece of paper, and James is like, "What?" And then grabs it and realizes it's lyrics, and then kind of moves his chair like, away from him.
I heard about this. I never saw it because it was like I have, you know, my idea of Metallica, and sometimes too much is too much. You don't want to know shit.
It's we're in an overshare culture right now. We're definitely in an overshare culture.
Yeah, I was excited because I love that year and a half of the life of Metallica thing they put out because it was just like it was them how you wanted to see them just fucking getting wasted and just fucking goofing off and like messing around with each other recording and getting pissed off. And then I was like, can't wait to see this next one. Yeah, it was right. Just like Dave Mustaine crying.
It's so not like to do anything for a long period of time when you're young, you don't really think about that stuff, but do anything for a long period of time. So it's a process of becoming unsexy to make it happen eventually.
Well, the thing is whatever it is that you end up doing, however you handle it, as far as I'm concerned, because I'm more of a fan than anything. Like I love what I do, and it's got its sort of like how you deal with it and all. It's got its own pressures and whatnot. But I got into music more as a fan, so I still look at it from a fan perspective. There's just shit you don't want to know. Yeah. And so you have whatever you have to do in your own personal world. You don't need to put it out there necessarily.
You don't need
personal stuff. Some people find it interesting. Some people find it helpful because it helps them deal with their own problems, whatever. But in the bigger picture, most people just don't want to know about that. They just want you to make your whatever your product is and go out and perform.
Yeah, right.
It's like when I remember a friend of mine showed me this band, Screwdriver. And I was like, this is great. And he's all, yeah, these guys are Nazi skinheads. Like, oh no.
No.
Why didn't you tell me that first?
I went and bought the T-shirt and everything.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. I got their cool logo. Oh no!
Yeah, it's like four L's. Yeah, yeah. Oh no! I didn't look at it. Oh no! Well,
that's quite a laugh, you guys.
Kyle's very excitable. He's our Muppet. Kyle's like our Muppet.
Yeah, yours.
That's yours. Right. But we're about at an hour, man. That was.
Haven't we been here?
Yeah,
that
was an hour.
We got a movie coming out, though, right?
I do. We haven't even talked about.
Let's talk about the movie before we let you go.
I'm a great, great promoter. I got this movie called Nothing Left to Fear, which turned out really great. I'm really stoked about it. And it opens Friday here in Burbank at the AMC 16.
Oh, nice.
But then we have a screening for it, a public screening, where we're going to do a Q&A. Me and the director, Anthony Leonardi, are going to do a after the movie, and we're going to go up and take questions from the fans and all that. So it's been a lot of fun. It's been quite an interesting process producing my first horror film.
And that's fantastic. So what did you do? Did he come to you, or did you guys? How did you guys get to come together?
Well, I mean, initially what happened was I had I don't know, however many Halloweens ago, like five Halloweens ago, I had this great extensive conversation with a producer about horror, because it's a subject I never get to talk about with any of my friends or my wife or anything. Nobody wants to talk to me about that shit. And so, but I'm a huge horror buff since I was really little. And so we had this conversation about horror at this apartment of his where he does a very elaborate Halloween party, you know, like one of the coolest, from a visual standpoint, the stuff that he puts up and all that stuff.
Oh, nice.
So we had this conversation and he goes, you know, you should be a producer. And I was like, yeah, right. Anyway, so and so, but then he kept nursing this idea, and we kept in touch. And over the course of a year, he started sending me a lot of scripts, and I can read scripts, and so I get really into these scripts. And eventually, I would pick out the ones I liked and picked out the ones I didn't like, or throw those away and tell him why I didn't like him, and so on. And finally, we picked this one story that seemed like it was really doable, and that was Nothing Left to Fear.
Wow.
And so we said, okay, let's do this. And off we went, and we announced Slasher Films at Sundance like 3.5 years ago or something like that. And then we started developing the script and then started looking for directors, and I met a bunch of different directors, but picked Anthony Leonardi, who's just an immensely talented young guy. And next thing you know, we were, you know, casting and doing the whole. And I'm one of those people, I was a real busybody, so I had to be involved with every aspect of this. And scored the soundtrack did the theme song for it and all that kind
of
stuff.
What's it about?
It's, in a nutshell, without sort of letting the cat out of the bag, It's about a young, God-fearing family who, you know, basically are invited to relocate to this small rural town called Stull in Kansas, basically so that the father, who's a pastor, can take over the congregation from the pastor that's existing because he's going to retire. But it turns out the whole idea was a front for a way more sinister plot.
Oh, that sounds like fun. But,
it's a cool sort of old school kind of movie.
Yeah, like, I was going to say it sounds like when it's like, hey, we're going to move to this town.
Yeah,
and then
yeah,
like
yeah.
there's a skeptical kid. Or, you know, there's yeah. the
well, Children of the Corn.
not quite like that, but it's one of these things where it's really about developing the characters and sort of the drama before it turns into a horror movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is what I was always turned into. Was I always thought, you know, of like in the 70s, especially horror movies were these sort of very involved, where you really got to understand each of the characters, and there was a sort of a history mm-hmm. going on, and you get to know these people, and it was just a drama that all of a sudden took this horrific turn.
When people had attention, that's when people had attention spans.
Yeah, exactly. So this is along those lines. So it really, you get to know the family, and you get to know the people in the town, you get to know the pastor that brought them there, and all that kind of stuff, and then all of a sudden it just sort of like takes a weird little shift, and then it just goes rampant from there on.
Did you see The Last Exorcist?
I did.
Yeah, yeah. That was a very
Last
big
Exorcism.
Surprise.
Or
The Last Exorcism. Yeah.
And then came out with the second one. I said, "Well, I thought they had the last one."
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The
yeah.
really last.
Yeah, yeah. For real. Yeah. For real this time. For real this time.
The second to the this is the ultimate.
Yeah. But I love, not to give anything away, but I love that movie, like, you know, started off as one idea and then slowly turned into
exactly.
that. And then by the end of it, you're just like, oh, shit.
Yeah, you get sucked into it. And, you know, the main thing is you start to develop, you know, more or less an empathy for the people, you know, different characters in the movie, so that when it goes off, you actually feel something that they're going through. Because most characters in horror movies these days are pretty disposable from the get-go. You know, as soon as you walk in the theater, this is what you're going to get.
Yeah. Right. I hope that gorgeous person gets killed.
Each of those living people are going to die.
Yeah.
It's a Final Destination is a model for that.
Yeah.
But
there
was that period of horror where they were really almost these weird Christian morality tales of horror of like, oh, those kids having premarital sex, they're going to die. Yeah. Oh, those are,
that was like the slasher movie.
Yeah.
Well, some of those movies are really good, and it's you know, and they're fun.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen some good ones, and I've seen some really bad ones, and I've seen some really disconcerting, you know, torture porn ones where you're just like, I'm glad that the writer has this outlet. You know? It's like I really want you to see graphically how we're going to do this. So it's all going to be very, very slow and painful.
I really liked the period in the 70s where, you know, they had to get inventive because they just didn't, the effects weren't that great.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of stuff that you did that you would never even see.
But that's one of the cool things. I mean, probably unbeknownst to them at the time. It's like, it's that sort of has that mystique of what you don't see, which makes you rely on your imagination, which is the darkest place on the planet.
Yeah.
And so when you have to evoke stuff from there, it paints a really dark picture, and you didn't have to spell it out.
Yeah.
You just sort of like give the suggestion or the idea of something that's going to happen, or what, you know, like, I know that happened. I didn't see it. And then your mind tells you what it would look like.
Yeah,
And I like that a lot better. I like to be sort of engrossed in from a psychological point of view of just sort of like, you know, the suspense of waiting for, you know, something to happen, but not necessarily seeing what it is, but you know what it was, and that makes it that much scarier.
Yeah, that's what I love so much about Ty West's movies, like House of the Devil and then Innkeepers. It's just the same kind of thing where it's just mostly tension and just like fear of what might happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Or what you might
see.
Or
what's going to happen. I mean, there was a movie called The Strangers that came out that I just happened to see by mistake one night. Because I was pretty inebriated for most of the 90s, but I stopped watching.
Me too!
I stopped watching horror movies like from the 90s through the first half, you know, like say when I say first half of the first decade of the millennium, let's put it that way, because they were all very predictable and whatnot.
Yeah, they
were.
But
I was flipping channels one night and hanging out on the couch, and there was a movie that was just starting. So I said, okay, let's check this out. And it was, and Liv Tyler was in it. And so I just watched it, and it was one of the most suspenseful, you know, movies I'd seen in a really, really long time. And it doesn't, you don't really get it till the very end of it, you know.
Yeah, and that was a remake, right?
The Strangers?
Yeah.
Not that I know of.
Was it, or am I thinking about Funny Games? Funny Games is a remake. But that came, they both came out around the same time, right, which had a very similar...
Funny Games, if I remember correctly, is a remake.
Yeah, yeah, but it was similar, like people in a house and then people coming in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, what was I getting at? Oh, and Rosemary's Baby was one of my favorite movies from way back in the day. And this one sort of is that kind of a thing where you just sort of like, what's going to happen?
How fun
is anything going to happen?
Yeah.
Is this still a horror movie?
How fun to drop Rosemary's Baby on people though, because like now if you did a movie like people go, oh, this is like Rosemary's Baby, but to drop that then people would be like, what the fuck, you know?
Yeah.
You were just about to say something.
Oh, no, I was thinking, but I already said it. Never mind.
Oh,
I was getting into the Rosemary's Baby thing.
But just the idea that you know, how fun in the you know, 60s and 70s where you could actually really surprise people cinematically with horror because they hadn't been surprised
in
that way
yet.
Well,
that was a particularly gruesome story for that time. That really got under people's skin because you're talking about a baby. I mean, that's a sort of, you know, sacred subject, you know, and and the people and even the husband all in on it, you know, and like that really makes people uncomfortable.
Satan is his father.
That's why religion is such a popular subject in general for horrors, because that's supposed to be a safe place.
Yeah.
You know,
at
least, you know, ideally, that's supposed to be a safe place. And then what happens is you put your trust and faith in and it turns around to bite you.
Yeah. And it's no good. And
it's like Cujo. That fucked with people too.
Yeah.
That's your family dog.
Yeah.
Cujo was such a fucking great one.
And the ocean. When Jaws came out, everybody was like fine with the ocean until Jaws came out.
Yeah.
It's like you take the places where people like to feel, where they feel most
at peace.
Yeah, especially in your own home, you know, like we're talking about the strangers.
Yeah.
And you got home invasions. Those are the kind of things that really get under people's
skin. When a stranger calls.
Yeah.
Get out of the house. The call's coming from inside the house.
Or Omen, which was one of my favorite horror movies of all time.
Oh, the fucking original Omen was amazing.
Yeah, yeah. It was one of the most well-told stories and original. And Gregory Peck was great. So it was like a feature film that, you know, and you had, and he's in politics, you know, he's, what was he? He was the secretary.
Of defense or something?
No. He was the ambassador to the U.S. in... one of the European.
Are you talking about countries. Like the one with Sam Neill?
No.
The original. Yeah. Because in the Sam, like the Omen was one of the first when I first started to understand, like, oh, these are a franchise of these things. Because I did the second one where Damien's like in boarding school, and then they did the Final Conflict, I think, which is where Sam Neill, like, he's going to be president and he's going to fucking blow up the world. Or it was like just watching.
But the first one, Gregory Peck played Thorne, and. He was a U.S. ambassador for, I don't know if it was Germany or it wasn't France. But anyway, so, and there's his wife and they have this new son. It's all perfect. They've got this great big house. And then you find out that your newborn son's the son of Satan.
Oh, what a bummer.
And,
that was mine.
And, you know, that's, and then get told that he's going to, you know, create enemies on both sides till man exists no more. So he's in the world of politics, and that was great, you know, really well told and great story.
Yeah, weaving religion into politics and then making,
and that's what all the sequels were.
Right,
was him. You know, first he's going to a military school. He's a little older, right?
Yeah,
and he's coming up, and then finally becomes president. And
Would you ever want to remake? Would you ever want to make a film like that, or do you want to stick to the original?
A lot of movies don't need to be remade, and it's really really disenchanting when people do.
Yeah,
you know, and make them a lot worse. It really cheapens the original. Some stuff you can find really old stuff that can be remade. I mean, I think The Thing was a good remake.
I thought The Thing. And are you talking about Carpenters? Or
yeah,
the one
Carpenters.
That just came out?
Carpenters.
Yeah, yeah, which was, I guess, pretty cool. But Carpenters is probably the best remake of all time.
Yeah, well, that and Invasion of the Body Snatchers with
Donald Sutherland.
That was a good one too, and I'm sure if we sat here, we could think of a couple.
I thought the remake of Night of the Living Dead was
not so bad.
Was pretty good. It was done by holy shit, I'm forgetting the makeup artist.
There were so many Night of the Living Dead or Living Dead ones that I can't even tell. Was there actual remake of the original, or are they? Because
it was a remake of the original. It was a
1990.
Yeah, Tom Savini.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Savini did it, and Tony Todd was in it, and it was like, you know, it it was just as slow and just as it was really good. Yeah. And then they made the female lead a little bit less of a babbling idiot. Like she was like a little bit more strong right. by the end of it. So
I never saw it because it was. I think there was a long string in the 80s of Return of the Living Dead,
which I think is
which
great.
Was great.
Yeah,
but the there was a bunch of other ones.
But they got silly, a little silly.
Yeah, and I think James Gunn's Dawn of the Dead remake is great.
Dawn of the Dead. The Dawn of the Dead remake is
But the Day of the Dead remake is one of the worst things I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember Dawn of the Dead when it came out. But Night of the Living Dead, the original, I saw with my mom. And it was a double feature with The Exorcist.
Oh, jeez.
And so I was like I said, I got weaned on horror really, really early.
Yeah.
But we saw it in the back of a Volkswagen at a drive-in, her and her girlfriend and me in the back seat. And the original Night of the Living Dead just scared the hell out. Exorcist had nothing on the Night of the Living
yeah.
Dead. It was because it was so raw and it was so, like, you know, ominous.
Yeah.
You know?
And looked like news footage.
And the people, you know, as zombies looked just like it, you know, and it was just like a lot of But the thing that made the biggest impression on me was the daughter with the spade.
And oh, her mom yeah, yeah.
pleading, you know, and not really believing that her daughter was a zombie.
Yeah.
And then her just coming in. And that's always stuck with me. So yeah. I have to check out the new one because I think if the new one came out in 1990, I wasn't around.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's like, you know, I like the fact that it was Tom Savini and it was produced by Romero.
I got
Romero.
To meet him recently.
Oh, really?
I was starstruck.
He yeah. seems like a real weird dude.
No, he was really very animated and like, you know, conversationalist,
yeah. yeah.
Some for want of a better word. I was really sort of taken aback. Yeah. I was expecting a much more dark individual.
But, yeah. I like to think that he's just like Sex Machine, his character from Dust Till Dawn.
You might get disappointed.
No whip.
Well, this was right. great, man. I really appreciate you coming
this is
and hanging
great,
out.
Do you do this here all the time?
Yeah.
Oh, it's awesome.
It's a great space. Yeah, I mean, just
I'm
to
coming
look
down
out.
Every week.
No, yeah. You can come out and look at the comic stacks, and then we took
That's
over
what I'm
the,
do.
We
okay.
took over the space next door, and we do live shows downstairs, and it's fucking – this has been like – a when you're a kid and you go – someday I'm going to have a clubhouse and we're going to make shows and have comics and do live shows. Like, it's literally everything. Jonah yeah. produces a Wednesday night stand-up show. You could come in and watch stand-up. People yeah. are playing Dungeons and Dragons out on the
Wait,
sun.
David Kechner comes over.
Kechner?
Yeah,
yeah, he's
comes
a friend
by.
Of mine.
Oh,
yeah,
nice.
He's told me about this, and I just haven't come down.
Yeah, he's done it
and
a bunch.
And he came to my last show, so I have to come down and check him out.
Yeah, next time he's on,
but you know,
I'll
this,
you
this
know.
Place used to be a baby supply.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it was a baby supply store for a long time.
Wow.
Yeah. Like you could buy cribs.
Babies?
And
oh, you could buy cribs. Yeah, yeah.
No, supplies.
Oh, supplies. I'm sorry.
Well, there was supply babies. Okay.
There was a supply.
Backup babies.
Yeah, we get the baby stack.
Yeah.
Now, when it was a hardware store.
It was a hardware
store. Before it was a baby supply. Right?
Yeah. Originally, this whole building was a bakery.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, because in the back where the theater is, there were all these extra just structures hanging down from when there was like hardware, like when they basically stored a lot of the hardware. But yeah, how long has Gaston been here? 90.
He's been here almost 20 years.
Almost 20 years.
And you know Tower Records, right?
Yeah.
Or Tower Records, Tower Video. Tower Video is being turned into a bank, but before it was Tower Video, it was like one of those stereo supply, I can't even remember the name of it, it's been so long, stereo supply stores, you know, where you go in and you buy speakers and all that kind of. And then, but when I was a kid, it was a go-go bar.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Weird.
And I used to always want to go in there. I was like 6, 7 years old. Hey.
On the dirt bike.
So whenever I look at it, when I used to work at Tower Video, I always thought of it that way.
Oh,
it's
that's
like
funny.
A naked girl stood here.
Paul F. Tompkins also worked at that Tower Video.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Bob Hoskins.
No,
Paul F. Tompkins.
Bob Hoskins.
Yeah, Bob Hoskins. He was researching the role for like 10 years.
Like right before I worked there.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was right after Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thanks. You're welcome back anytime you want.
Yeah, man. Well, I'm going to go down and shop now.
Yeah, yeah. Go down and shop and please come back.
I can see it now coming home with a truck full of this stuff. Hey, honey.
What did you do?
Because I got more of that stuff we just sold.
And I'm thinking about having my birthday party this year at the Natural History Museum. You can rent out wings of the Natural History Museum.
At the LA one?
At the LA
you
one.
You should. Alan Trust Warren me. I mean, there. Go check it out before you know, because it's rad.
If I do, would you come to my birthday party? If I invited you, would you come to my birthday party?
I might.
Okay.
I don't know. Oh, no, I'm busy. No, it's more of a schedule thing. It's like,
oh, yeah. No, I'm sure. Yeah,
when is your birthday?
I'm sure everyone's got a schedule. No, unfortunately, my birthday's right before Thanksgiving, which fucks everything up every year.
I will be in South America.
Oh, could you come back?
I will, but it won't be your birthday.
Shit.
But I'll come back here and I'll bring you some.
Okay,
I'll bring you some South American something.
South American dinosaur bones. Right. Just a hollow femur or just something.
Oh, yeah, right.
Something. All right. Thanks. Enjoy your brood, everyone.
All right, man.
Goodbye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.